நண்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்களது இனிய காலை வணக்கங்கள். இன்று வெப் மீட்டிங் ஆன் லைஃப் டிவைன் இப்பொழுது தொடங்க இருக்கிறது. கேரி சார் அவர்கள் தி நாலேஜ் அண்ட் இக்னரன்ஸ் என்ற தலைப்பில் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். நவ் ஐ ஆம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் அண்ட் டெலிவர் தி ஸ்பீச்.
Good morning. Today's talk will be on familiar territory. Up until now, we've been in the stratosphere of supramental knowledge and Satchidananda. But with this chapter, Sri Aurobindo comes down to earth where we live. And he talks about the world we live in, the consciousness we live in, which is the consciousness of ignorance. He does that not to find fault with us, but to help us understand where we are and what is the source of all our problems, limitations, and difficulties so we can awaken out of it. The last two chapters on cosmic illusion, he has gone to great length to persuade us that however dark, ignorant, how much suffering, whatever there is in the world, this world is not an illusion. This life is not an illusion. We may be living in an illusion, that's different. But the world we live in is very real. And it's a manifestation of Brahman. It's a manifestation of Satchidananda. In this chapter, he asks the fundamental question. If everything is a manifestation of Satchidananda, if everything is an expression of spirit, then why is the world the way it is? Why are we the way we are? What is this thing called ignorance? How is it created? Why does it exist? What is its purpose? He's going to tell us ignorance is the first fact of our existence. We're born knowing nothing. He has a line in Savitri, man doesn't even know the step in front. We don't even know what's going to happen the next minute. Who's going to come in the door? Who's going to call on the phone? What's going to happen? What's going to come in the post or the email? Or we don't know even the next second. We don't know about the future, even about the past. We don't know why the things have happened the way they have happened. We have a little understanding, but why this or that happened, why I am here and not there. Even now, what's happening elsewhere, we don't know. Or why things are happening the way they are. We're ignorant about how to solve our problems. We're ignorant about how to accomplish our goals. We're baffled by why other people act the way they do, just the way those other people are baffled by why we act the way we do. We are ignorant not only about others, we are ignorant about ourselves. We also wonder why we act the way we do sometimes. I wonder whether Mr. Bennett ever figured out why he married Mrs. Bennett. I certainly haven't figured it out. I wonder whether he ever figured it out. Elizabeth is constantly bewildered and puzzled. Why is that man staring at me like this? What does he mean by staring? Why does he ask me to dance? He thinks only savages should dance. What's going on here? Why did Wickham unnecessarily create this scandalous lie about Darcy and cause all of this trouble? What in the world did he have in mind when he eloped with Lydia? Certainly it wasn't marriage. Why did Mr. Bennett send Lydia? This is an intelligent man. Why did he send her to Brighton? Surely he should have known better. Why did Mrs. Bennett insist on keeping secret her plans for Lizzie to marry Collins? How could she ever think that Lizzie would accept Collins? It's a wonder when we know, knowing what she knew about Lizzie. Why did Kitty keep the secret when she knew that there was a plan, some plan of Lydia for elopement? What made Darcy come to Pemberley just at the moment he came? We can give all our explanations. They're only explanations, but the fact of the matter is, we don't know. Most things we don't know. This is our starting point. And in this chapter, he starts where we are. And the rest of the chapters in part one are about the ignorance, what it is, how it's created, and what purpose it serves. And then the last 14 chapters in part two are about how we move from the ignorance to the knowledge, spiritual evolution. So this subject, which is the subject of our lives, is too big to cover in one chapter. He's going to take it in detail, step by step, to help us unravel the mystery of where we are and why we are where we are. This is the first step. He starts by going back to the Book one, to the chapter on the sevenfold cord of being, to remind us clearly that the fundamental nature of the world we live in. He says that the seven principles of existence, which we discussed in part one, existence, consciousness, you had conscious force. The second, Ananda, bliss, delight, supermind, mind, life, matter. And if you include the psychic, it becomes the eighth. The tradition was talking about seven. He said, all of these are rays of the divine being. All of these are colors of the divine light in manifestation. He had two chapters on matter in which he unraveled the mystery and said, matter is Satchidananda. If matter, which is the very opposite of Satchidananda, the very opposite of our conception of spirit, is itself spirit, then certainly life must be spirit, mind must be spirit, supermind is spirit. All are expressions or rays of the infinite. But that's certainly not the way we experience them. So whatever their reality may be, unless we know them in their reality, we are ignorant. So having told us this is the reality, now he's going to talk about us and help us understand why we don't know the reality, why we don't see the reality as it is, why we are not able to recognize the spirit as it is. The Vedic tradition is very clear. They speak about the seven words of the ancient sages, the words of manifestation, the sounds of manifestation. These are the seven planes of existence. Well, if, in fact, all that this world is made of is really spirit, then a world of ignorance can't be inevitable. We live in the world as ignorance, but in ignorance can't be inevitable. There's a possibility for us to come out of the ignorance. Why we are in the ignorance, why the ignorance is created, he's going to tell us, not in this chapter, here a little, but later in much more detail. But if everything really is a manifestation of spirit, then this can't be the only possibility for us. And this was the conclusion that the Vedic rishis came to so many thousands of years ago. They did not believe that the world is an illusion. They did not believe that we are destined, condemned to perpetual suffering on a wheel of karma like Buddhism. They did not believe that the only possibility for us was to get out of this, to go for some moksha, to look for some delight or heaven elsewhere. They believed in the possibility that this life in this world could become divine, that the seven principles of spirit could reveal themselves and express themselves here. They believed also that that greater world already existed, that there was a world that already existed in which truth prevailed, knowledge prevailed, not ignorance. It's referred constantly in the Vedic Rigs as the truth, the right, the vast. This world that they strive to reach, a world of the truth, the right, and the vast. In the beautiful imagery of the Veda, where the sun unyokes his horses, where the sun, where the dawn reaches to the world of splendor, and it stops, has no longer any place to go. Where the thousand rays of consciousness stand as one. They knew that world existed above. They believed that the destiny of humanity was to build that world of us, was to build that world in ourselves, was to uncover the knowledge buried in the unconscious. There are so many images in the Veda about the cows of light, which are captured in the caves, the dark subconscious caves, by the thieves, the Panis, and they have to be liberated. The light has to be liberated from the unconscious. Only thing is, everybody's forgotten what this means. Sri Aurobindo has written and explain what the old Rigs really meant. That there is, the light is there buried in the darkness. How can the light be there buried in the darkness? The very inconscient is not the opposite of the superconscient light. It is the light buried and hidden there. And the goal of man is to uncover that light, to liberate the spirit that's hidden in the darkest depths of the inconscient. He says, the inconscient is not only concealing that light, but it's guarding that light, which is our future prize. It's the treasure that's waiting for us here on earth. This is what the mystics believe. For them, this was the justification for our existence. The justification for our existence was not getting a house, getting a car, getting married, getting a seat in the education, or any of such things. The justification for our existence was discovering the principles of divinity in ourselves, realizing them, the knowledge, the bliss, the immortality, the freedom in life, in the world. To us, that is to humanity, this very conception seems paradoxical, impossible. It just, we look around us to a world where people are born and they die, where we all have weaknesses, we all have limitations, we all have ignorance without exception. If the key word of the ideal creation that the rishis dreamed of was infinite self-consciousness, an infinite power, an infinite delight, that's not the world that we're living in. That's not the experience we're having. The key word of our creation is the very opposite. We start from inconscience. We emerge out of the darkness. We start as completely victims of the world around us, helpless, subject to the forces of the world around us, whether it's a cyclone or a disease or something else. We are constantly, for us, life is a struggle. Nature seems to be a blind force that acts on us with no consideration for our comforts, our convenience, or our aspirations. This is the world in which humanity grew up, in the forest, struggling against all the hardships of nature. And we have made a lot of progress. We have come a long way. But still today, we see too much of the limitation, the suffering, the ignorance, and the difficulties around us. To our perception, to the perception of the scientist, the origin of everything is not some divine Satchitananda. The origin of everything is some dark, inert, not, we can't even say it's dead, it was never alive, some inert existence that has no consciousness, no intention, certainly no delight. And everything has come out of that, whether you call it a Big Bang or whatever you want to call it. And according to that view, there's no place for a soul. Actually, there's no place even for us. There's no place for conscious human beings, unless we want to convince ourselves that we're only a bunch of molecules and atoms jumping together and electrical impulses hopping back and forth. This is the normal view. And that's why humanity has long ago abandon the idealism of the Vedic rishis. The rishis were not idealists. They actually saw the reality. Whether they realized it or not, they saw that possibility. They believed in it. That's why the first paragraph of Life Divine, in the first chapter, Human Aspiration, he says that immortal aspiration of humanity, God, light, freedom, immortality. It's been there from the very beginning. From the very beginning means from the Vedic age. How could the rishis have sensed this or known this at the very beginning? It's a principle that the Appa has referred to many times. The end shows itself in the beginning. The goal shows itself as a flash in the very beginning. The whole Vedic period, a brief period in the whole history of humanity, was the glimpse, like the dawn at the beginning of the day, that beautiful moment, just a flash of a moment when the sky is full of colors and brilliance and life looks glorious, and then we go to the ordinary life of day, and oh, the dawn was just some illusion or something like that. That's not the way life really is. That's why he started Savitri with the symbol dawn. The Vedic experience was the symbol dawn of our future destiny. But if you listen to the scientist, be rational, be reasonable. Don't get all of these high expectations. You'll be lucky that with modern medicine and everything, you can live much longer than your ancestors lived. You can live more comfortably. You can have AC. You don't have to suffer in the 41 degree temperature. We can have more food. We can have conveniences. You can have iPod if you like that, or watch the TV serials. Be modest in your expectations and aspirations. The best you can hope for is a comfortable material existence. That's what they tell us, and even in spiritual India, that's the dream that is selling today. That's the dream that has the greatest appeal. It's for that that we vote for our political leaders, and it's that that we teach our children, and it's that that we wake up hoping for more of every day, because maybe there's nothing else. Even the religions of all the world have long ago abandoned any hope of a divine life on earth or a spiritual life. In the Christian religion, it's a heaven. There's a kingdom. There's a heaven to go to. Where is it? It's not here. The heaven begins only when this is over. That tells you something. No? If the real heaven begins only when life is over, that tells you how much they have given up any hope that that this can be divine. And in the philosophies, it's the same thing. And the philosophies, the metaphysical philosophies of India went even further and said, this is an illusion. This simply is an illusion, or in Buddhism, it's something to escape. But in the Vedas, they said that there are two sides of existence. The ignorance is real. And we can't be fooling ourselves and trying to, some of the modern psychology, they want to deny the fact that there's anything called evil. Because, how could there be evil? We are only just animals. Evil is true. Falsehood is true. Ignorance is true. But it's not the only truth. There's also a light of spirit. That's the ignorance is true and the knowledge is true. And the whole mystery that he tries to address this chapter is, what's the relationship between the knowledge and the ignorance? How can they both exist? Let's be clear. If the world is all illusion, if the world is all suffering, at least we understand why it's the way it is. If the world is all divine, then it doesn't make sense. But how can it be both? If the world is created by Maya, then it can be an illusion. But if the world is a manifestation of Brahman, where does the ignorance come in? You should have only knowledge. So this simultaneous existence of the two opposites has been the greatest puzzle for humanity for all time. And it's that puzzle he wants to answer in this chapter. And in the Vedas, they said, behind the knowledge and behind the ignorance, there is something more. There is a reality. It's one reality. And when we reach that reality, we will understand both the knowledge and the ignorance. And he tells us, maybe he's the first to tell us, we will also understand why the ignorance has been created, what purpose it solves, what essential role it plays in the divine plan. That's a future chapter. So the Veda, all throughout the Indian tradition, no other tradition in the world, there has been this possibility, this idea of the possibility of perfection. The possibility that human beings could be perfected, that society could be perfected. He mentions the Alwar's vision of the descent of Vishnu and gods upon earth, the reign of the saints, the city of God, the millennium. So that dream has been there. He wants to tell us it's not just a dream. It's the future. The problem is that these intuitions, these inspirational vision, these promises of a bright future, there's no certitude to them. There's nothing concrete that we can grab on to say, yes, yes, clearly this is true. It sounds very nice. We would like to believe it. We'd all like to believe it. But is it really true? So why this irreconcilable opposition between knowledge and ignorance? He says, we have to start with the facts of existence. We have to understand the facts of existence. Look at the facts of existence impartially, clearly, in order to understand what this ignorance is. And he says, the roots of ignorance, the very source of the ignorance that we live in, it has its roots in the nature of mind. Mind, which is that which characterizes the human being, is the source of the ignorance we live in. He says, the very nature of mind, the office of mind, the role of mind, is to measure things, limit things, particularize. Particularize means to take things and divide them into separate things and look at each thing particular, individually, separate from everything else. And that should be understandable to us because we do it all the time. We distinguish ourselves. We're constantly making distinctions. This is mine, not yours. This is my family. This is my property. This is my achievement. We constantly set ourselves apart from others, like Lady Catherine, which does it very boldly and outwardly. We do it quietly, hopefully, to ourselves. She's so outraged. If Lizzie should marry Darcy, she says, "What are the woods, the trees of Pemberley to be polluted?" For her, it's like it's a catastrophe. Why? Because she has particularized and divided. No, you don't belong. You are not somebody that my nephew can marry. It was there in the paper or on Google, the Hindu this morning. Some girl fell in love with a scheduled caste boy, and her parents said, "We disown her, and if she comes home, we can't be responsible if she commits suicide," meaning if we kill her. No, she doesn't belong to us anymore. Because we're capable of saying, that's what Lady Catherine says. It's impossible. She may be a human being, she may breathe, she may think, she may live in everything, but it's impossible my nephew should marry her because the distinctions are so real to her. At every moment, we distinguish and particularize. Mrs. Bennett praises life in the countryside and thinks there's nothing to compare with it. Darcy says every savage can dance. Carolyn looks down on everybody as inferior to her and says, look at the hem of her dress, which has got mud on it. Look at the hair which is blown, look at the suntan on the face. All of this is objectionable. Darcy talks about what it's necessary to be an accomplished woman. You have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do this, you have to do that. Our minds are judging things all the time like this and failing to see the reality. And the character of our mind is that we always affirm our point of view as the one and true point of view. We look out on the world and say, why isn't everybody as reasonable as I am? Why doesn't everybody understand the truth? Meaning, my point of view, my understanding. Why isn't everybody like me? But Aurobindo says, the mind is not just a dividing instrument. It's also a universalizing instrument. It also has the capacity to go beyond division, to see relationships, to see larger wholes of which everything is a part. India just finished this national election, and everybody's having their own opinion and commenting on whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Now Congress is out, BJP is in and everything, and she's won a landslide here and all. But the thing that struck me most about the election was, if you look for the last 50, 60 years, there's been a steady trend from national party to regional parties. That is, the sense of unity that India had when it was fighting the British, that everybody voted for the Congress because they were voting for India. But after independence, the DMK started here, no, we must vote for the Tamil. The Telugu started there. All the regional parties started. The caste parties started. Everybody started particularizing, dividing. India became politically one, but it was divided in its consciousness, and all that division got emphasized. And so for the last, since 1984, or maybe after Rajiv, there's been no dominant national party. Even when the Congress has been in party, it's always been a coalition. Since 84, I think they've never had an absolute majority, no? And now what happens? A national party gets a majority. Which party it is secondary. It means that apart from the capacity, everybody would have predicted, I would have predicted that we'll see more and more fragmentation and no national party will ever get a majority again. And that happens in many countries. You have Netherlands. I think they have 30 political parties, and they haven't had a national party in power in decades. It's always coalitions, and the coalitions last for a year or two, and then they quarrel. It's true in many countries, Italy and Israel and so many places. But what happened here? Surprise! The Indian electorate, which everybody says is uneducated and uninformed and only votes for their own benefit, has chosen something else. So it means there's another possibility there. This particularizing faculty is not the only capability that we have, even though we insist on it most of the time. He says, so there's nothing wrong in particularizing. This is a pink shirt and that's a green shirt, and this is a red sari, and so forth and so on. That's what the mind does. It distinguishes. Nothing wrong with that. He's tall, she's short. Nothing wrong with that. But it becomes ignorance when we begin to judge people by their height or by the color of their sari or by how much money they have or by how much education they have, and fail to see the reality behind. We are not only all human beings, we are all souls. We are all manifestations of the divine. Our problem comes not because we're capable of distinguishing. Our problem comes because when I distinguish, I think that my way is better than everybody else's way, and everybody should be like me. And I don't see the uniqueness, the spiritual truth behind everything else. In other words, when we particularize and divide, we see only the differences and we lose sight of the unity. We lose sight of the oneness. And this is the origin of the ignorance. Mind has been created to help us create the rich diversity of the world. But when mind, that's what supermind has done, manifested the one as diversity, infinite diversity. But when supermind has become mind, it has lost the habit or the power of seeing the oneness behind the multiplicity, seeing that which unifies us behind that which distinguishes and separates and divides us. That is the origin of the ignorance. And we see it reach its acme in the religions, when religions become fundamentalist. Religions which are supposed to be talking about God's work on earth and the divinity of human beings, saying, there was a news last month from Libya. One Muslim lady married a Christian, and they legally sentenced her to death. Not that somebody went and killed her. By law, they said she is guilty of the greatest crime and she must be sentenced to death. But that sounds barbaric to us, but every religion has done it. Every religion has said, we are God's children and everybody else is evil or a sufferer or destined to suffer because they don't know the truth that I know. So religion, which is supposed to be that which is closest to the unity and knowing the truth of things, has itself become the source of division and ignorance and insisted on our differences, and we fought so many wars. The Muslims and the Christians fought the Crusades. India, we had a partition. Everywhere there has been these wars because mind goes and focuses on the particular and loses the sight of the truth. So he says, exclusiveness is the soul of ignorance. Exclusiveness, the sense that I'm special. I have something others don't have, or I deserve something that others don't deserve. That's the whole premise of aristocracy, no? The aristocrat expects everybody should treat them deferentially, obey them. It's amazing when Lady Catherine comes to Longbourn. It comes out very well in the movie. She barges into the house. She doesn't even wait to be welcomed. She doesn't wait to be asked to sit down. She says, who is this woman? I suppose it's your mother. And I suppose that's your sister. And she has the arrogance, we call it temerity. She has the temerity to call Lizzie out and say, promise me you won't marry my nephew. It sounds barbaric. It sounds ridiculous. But obviously she thought that she might get away with it. She thought, after all, I'm an aristocrat. You should live your life according to the way it suits me. Sound familiar? Do we ever think that other people should live their lives the way it will suit us? This is not quite convenient for me. I had my intentions there. You see, I want my daughter to marry him, so please promise you won't do it. And if you don't promise, I'd be quite cross. I'd be quite upset. I'd be very displeased with you for not doing exactly what I say. Don't you know you're here to serve my selfishness? Don't you know you're here to live for my benefit? That is the ego in the ignorance. That's the source of religious conflict, the source of caste rivalries. And who can escape that, even when we're so lucky as to have been chosen or been graced by knowing Mother and Sri Aurobindo and Appa? It's hard not to feel special. It's hard not to feel different. And our very sense of feeling special or different is our capacity to convert knowledge into ignorance. Still raises a lot of questions about the ignorance that we have to answer. How is it that exists? What is this strange power of consciousness that does all of these things? What is the principle of its operation? How do we remove it? How do we get out of it? So he says, we have to know the facts of our consciousness. Let's observe the facts of our consciousness as we know them. And the first fact of our consciousness is that consciousness is power. Consciousness is power. Our consciousness creates the reality that we live in. This is the first fact. Our reality reflects our beliefs. If people, circumstances, events are what they are, or are not what we want, we have to first of all understand that the world we live in is a result of our consciousness. And if things outside are not quite perfectly the way Lady Catherine wants them or Mrs. Bennett wants them, the problem and the thing we need to look at is not out there. We need to look at here, because this consciousness has power. Our way of understanding, our way of looking at things, our way of believing has the power to create the world we live in. This is the primary fact of consciousness. If Darcy comes to Meriden and feels everything is wrong with everybody and these are all savages and all, it never occurs to him the problem is with him. Never occurs to him. He wants the whole world to change. It never occurs to him there's something he needs to change. It does finally occur to him, and he changes. That's why this story is so magnificent. We've all heard of the idea of self-fulfilling prophecy. If you drink some water and somebody says, oh, and you think, oh, maybe it's polluted, you end up getting sick. If you think that the stock market, if everybody believes that the stock market's at its peak and now it can't last, it won't last. It'll collapse. That's what happened in 2008. It kept going up and up, and people said, oh, this is too good to be true. And they were right. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mother says we create our own diseases by imagining all the things that can be wrong with us. We create them. Consciousness has power. We know that when we expect something good, it gets delayed. That we've a common theme. But we also know when you expect something bad, it happens. It fulfills itself. There's a second fact of consciousness. Mind creates illusions. Mind is constantly creating things that are not true, that are not real. Very obvious example in the story is Wickham. He consciously projects an illusion about himself and an illusion about Darcy. That, of course, is conscious. But Darcy has created an illusion about himself and the world, too. He thinks he's perfectly all right. He's a perfect gentleman, and everybody else is the problem. He finds fault even with Mr. Bennett. He finds fault with everybody around him. He adjusts with Bingley because he has to have some company in the world, but when he is really scratched the surface, he also feels that, you see, Bingley, you don't take responsibility, you don't take anything seriously, you're here today, gone tomorrow, you're all on impulse, you don't read books, you make a virtue out of foolishness. If you really want to speak freely, he won't approve of anybody. The capacity for mind to create illusion is wonderfully seen in Mr. Collins. Because he thinks he's the perfect human being. And he thinks that everybody's admiring him. He thinks that everybody values Lady Catherine and her chimneys and her staircases and the windows in the house as much as he does. And he's created that illusion about himself. Mary Bennett has certainly created an illusion that she's a virtuous person who's above all this dancing and all of these silly things. But the fact of the matter is she's a lonely girl who's been ignored and neglected by the family. And if anybody would come and dance her, she would dance all night. She would love to dance. Nobody wants to dance with her, so she says, I don't like dancing. I don't like these dances. Of course she doesn't like the dancers. Who wants to go there and sit while everybody else is dancing? But she creates an illusion, such an illusion, that she thinks if Collins married her, maybe she could improve him. She thinks she's superior and Collins needs her help, but maybe she could improve him. So, mind, our consciousness is a power of illusion that has the capacity to distort our perception of reality. We see it very clearly in Elizabeth. She sees Wickham's. She sees he's handsome. She sees he's friendly. He's flattering her. He's ignoring the other girls and giving all attention to her. He said, anybody who's so like this must be good. It's in the capacity for illusion. She's an intelligent girl. She's the clearest headed person in the story, maybe, and she's completely hoodwinked, as we say. She's completely misses the fact. When Darcy's staring at her at the dance, why is that man trying to intimidate me and finding fault with me? She's so lost in her ignorance, she doesn't see the man's in love with her. She doesn't see he can't keep his eyes off him. Inadvertently, he keeps looking. She completely misses the fact. Mrs. Bennett, when Mr. Bennett goes to London after to try to find Lydia, she's already sees that he's dueling with Wickham. She's imagining, it's real to her. They're going to duel and Mr. Bennett's going to be... Nobody was dueling at that time, especially over something like this. And Mr. Bennett's probably never handled a weapon in his life. Lady Catherine takes it to the greatest extent. She says, if I had taken to music, I would have been really exceptional. She not only has illusions about the present, she's able to imagine something that doesn't exist as a hypothetical and think that I would have been great at it. This is the capacity of the mind for illusion. He says something very interesting about mind. This is really very relevant to all of us, but particularly to the scientists. Mind affirms its own premises. Meaning, when mind justifies something, it's justifying, it's when we say, let's rationally come to it, what we really mean is when I rationally argue and tell you why we should do something, it's because I've already decided that this is the thing that should be done. My arguments are all in a circle to come back to where I want to come. It's what we call rationalization. What we call being reasonable is really rationalization, which means I will give you a set of arguments that justify what I want. Or I will give you a set of explanations that prove that what I believe is true. And if you give a set of arguments to believe that the opposite of what I believe is true, I say you're irrational. But the fact is we're using the same power and the same process because mind can be used to justify anything. It depends on your premises. The premise of the scientist is that this is inanimate, inorganic, inconscient, lifeless matter. And this is the origin of everything. And so every conclusion that science has come to is based on this premise. And if you say, wait, we have another premise here, the Schwerbindo says that this is actually spirit involved in matter. No, 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 don't talk nonsense. This is the, we don't discuss the premises. We only discuss the conclusion. Everybody knows that this is not alive. Everybody knows that this is what it is. Everybody knows means we insist on this as the assumption in the first place. We build our science on it. We build our religion on it. The holy wars of religion. Everybody knows that my religion is true. Everybody knows that my God is the real God. Everybody knows that I'm right and they're wrong, right? And we argue from it. This is the power of mind. Another fact of our existence is what he calls exclusive concentration. All our problems arise from the fact that we focus on one part of the truth or the illusion, whatever it is, and we ignore everything else. Everything that's inconsistent with that, we ignore. If we want to compare children, I compare my child on the thing that he's strongest. And I ignore the fact of any other capability. No, 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 my child is the brightest because he gets the best marks in the spelling. As if spelling is the only sign of intelligence in the world. Our exclusive concentration. We say, the common proverb is, we see the trees but not the forest. We see the part but not the whole. When Lydia elopes, it never occurs to Jane that this has an impact on Jane's life. She's very sorry for Lydia. But when Lizzie indicates, I fear that none of us will have any prospects anymore, it's a shock to Jane. She never thought about the connection. She was thinking of it as an isolated thing. When Mr. Bennett sends Lydia to Brighton, it never, Lizzie's already warned him. No, no, the only thing he's thinking of, I won't have any peace and quiet if we don't send her to Brighton. He doesn't think about the possibilities which are so obvious to us in retrospect. We think exclusively. When Carolyn invites Jane to Netherfield because she's anxious for some company, she never thinks about the possibility that she's not the only one who likes Jane. That her brother likes Jane also, and that if he likes Jane, he may fall in love with her, which he did. She never realizes she's the one who invited the enemy into her house. She's the one who started everything. When Darcy prevents Bingley from proposing to Jane and takes him away, it never, and tells him all the arguments why he cannot marry Jane, should not marry Jane, she's too low, inferior connections and all of that. It never occurs to him that he's going to want to marry Elizabeth, her sister, and all the arguments he's given to Bingley are going to come back. And what he does here is going to prevent him from doing that. And even when he went and proposed to Lizzie, it never occurred to him that because he has prevented Jane and Bingley, that that would have any impact on her decision. He never expected to be refused. Can anybody be so stupid? We can all be that stupid. We are all the time because we live exclusively. We concentrate exclusively on one point of view, which happens to be our point of view. At the particular moment, and we ignore all of the other possibilities, all of the other points of view. When Lizzie said to Darcy, it wasn't more than a month that I knew you that I decided you were the last man on earth I could ever marry. The same girl who said that within 1 year, 9 months, has decided he's the only man on earth that she wants to marry. But this is so real to her at the time. She's so angry with him. First of all, she thinks he's looking down at her and condemning her. She has no idea what his life is. She doesn't know the good character the man has. She doesn't know how much gratitude she must have for him. She has not thought of anything except that feeling at the moment when she sees handsome Wickham is really very nice. How can I think of marrying you when Wickham is there? That's, she's a serious girl in some respect. She says you're the last man, and when she says it, it looks convincing. To him, she's serious. She's convinced. He's convinced. The reader is convinced. Who would marry that? How would she marry that? But she married. So this is how deeply embedded we are in the ignorance. And then we have the ego's point of view. Never considers another point of view. When Collins proposes to Lizzie, he said, by all means, let me tell you all the reasons for my marrying and the reasons for my wanting to propose to you. He never even stops to say, now tell me what is your interest in marriage, or what are you looking for, or whether you feel the reasons for me. There's only one viewpoint. If I want to marry you, you must say yes, naturally. It's very obvious. That's the ego's viewpoint. Then we have another fact of our ignorance, and that is, whatever we prefer vitally, we mistake for the reality. What we like, what we want, we say is true. I already mentioned Lizzie's evaluation of Wickham. The truth is, this has nothing to do with the reality of Wickham. It has everything to do with the fact that she likes Wickham and she's been pleased by Wickham. And she thinks Wickham likes her, which is not particularly true. Wickham's just putting on a show. He's not worried about Lizzie. He's enjoying himself. He likes to be pleasant. He likes to move with company. That's all. And she was not able to distinguish what she likes, what's pleasant for her, from what's true. It's a common thing for us. If somebody's nice to me, we say, what do we say? He's a good man. Ah, that's a good man. Every time I go to that shop, he's very pleasant to me. He's a good man. It's very nice that he's pleasant, but does pleasantness to me have to do with goodness? If you really want to judge a person's character, it's much more important to see how they treat other people, not the way they treat us. Because even the man of bad character, when we're face to face, he'll smile and shake his head and very often be pleasant. But the moment we go away, but we tend to judge people the way they treat us, not the way they treat other people. Right in front of us, they'll be mean to other people. They'll speak badly of other people. We ignore it. No, that doesn't count. Another capacity of our ignorance is we convert something into its opposite. Mary has a sense of inferiority. She has convinced herself that she's superior to everybody around. And everybody around, they don't read the sermons the way I do. They don't practice the piano all the time the way I do. They're interested in dress and all of these things and dances, which I'm not. All of which she would drop everything if only she had an opportunity. But she's convinced herself of the opposite. We can think, see the rope and think it's a snake. But once we find out that the snake is really a rope, if we continue to tell everybody it's a snake or insist it's a snake, then it's something more than ignorance. It's ignorance that's become falsehood. It's falsehood that has a motive to it. And this is the capacity of our ignorance to turn something into its very opposite. Another characteristic of our ignorance, it makes us blind. Blind to other people's needs. When Rama was in the forest, for how long it was before Lakshmana ate? How long was Lakshman without eating or sleeping? Huh? 14 years. It never occurred to Rama to think about that. When one of the things that puzzled me most in the story was that when Wickham eloped with Lydia, I can understand, at least as a human nature, that a man can be attracted to a woman and want some enjoyment, but he knows in this society if he does that, he's ruining the whole family permanently. And he's been in the house, he knows the family, he seems to admire Lizzie, but he's done something that would ruin the whole family simply for a weekend spree. It's hard to imagine a more selfish act than that. Yet ignorance is such that we don't even consider the impact on other people and then decide, I don't care. We simply don't think about what will be the consequences for other people. Another version of ignorance is we see our faults in other people. Mr. Bennett is mocking Mrs. Bennett and having fun and laughing at Collins, not seeing his own inadequacies, not seeing that he's ruined his own family by neglecting the children. He's neglected all, if he knows Mrs. Bennett is a silly woman, how can he leave children in her charge and be so irresponsible and not think that his own behavior is laughable, something to be criticized? He thinks he's quite respectable. Everybody else is doing very silly things that he can have fun and mock. But he never sees that from the eyes of others, his own behavior is like that. Darcy looks down on the horrible behavior of Mrs. Bennett, never realizes that his own behavior is equally rude in many respects. Darcy was, This is the other side of it. If we see our faults in other people and condemn other people for the faults we have, it's equally true that we think nobody sees our faults. Even when we know we have them, we think we're the only one who knows. Carolyn is obviously very jealous of Lizzie, and she's trying to find fault with Lizzie and tease Lizzie and make Darcy think that Lizzie is low. So at one point at Netherfield, when they're talking about the accomplished women, and Lizzie says, well, I don't think there are 5 accomplished women in the world according to this standard. As soon as she goes, Carolyn says, the one thing that's really very bad is when a woman talks against other women to elevate herself. And Darcy shakes his head and says, yes, that's something really very bad. She thinks she's very cleverly condemning Lizzie, but Darcy and the reader are very clear. This is what she's doing. She's the mean person who's talking against other women to So thinking others can't see our faults. Another characteristic of our ignorance comes from our physicality. Because our consciousness is emerged from the physical, from the inconscient, we live in a physical consciousness. One of the characteristics of the physical consciousness is, I'll believe it when I see it. You know, they've done psychological studies with children. They say, would you like this candy now, or would you like 3 candies tomorrow? Every child says, I'll take this one now, because this is real. What we can see in front of us is real. Tomorrow it's only a possibility or something like that. It's not real. That's physicality. We believe what exists. Also, we believe what exists cannot change. It's impossible for Lizzie to conceive that Darcy could change. Once she has abused him, it's impossible, even after she knows he has saved the family by saving Lydia, she's unable to convince herself that he would ever come and propose again. It's impossible. First, that he would change was an utter amazement for her, that he could behave. The man who behaved one way at Hunsford and Meryton could behave differently at Pemberley. We are absolutely refuse to believe that anybody else can change. We tend to refuse to believe that anything can change. Of course, we can change. That's different. When Appa says India can be the most prosperous country, and Sherbindo says India can be the leader of the world, he used to send me to Delhi to the government people to talk about India's great potential in the future. And I went to a man at the Planning Commission who was from World Bank, who was specialist in looking at India's future. And when I told him Appa's ideas about India's future, he went and shut the door, so that nobody would hear, and he said, Mr. Gary, tell me truthfully, do you think India can ever develop? The interesting thing is, this is the man who's in charge of thinking of the future. He cannot. His mind is incapable. When he's supposed to think of the future, he can only think of the past, the present. That's the physicality of our ignorance. So when Sri Aurobindo says supramental life on earth, divine life on earth, man transformed all of this. The ignorant, our physical ignorance, that I see it, I believe it when I see it. I believe it when it happens. When Appa says 100 crores for each, we'll see. See. Sounds very nice, but I know. I know some of them believe. When it's here, then I'll. Of course, because of the power of our consciousness, it's only when we believe it, it will be here. So we are determining if it's not here. We have decided it's not here. We are loyal, very loyal to our ignorance. We think we're being loyal to Appa and Sri Aurobindo and Mother. We're very loyal to our ignorance. We will never, our faith is in our ignorance. Then we have another wonderful capacity of ignorance, which Appa calls Giraki. Whatever anybody says, we instinctively reject it. We instinctively say no. No, I disagree. No, that's not correct. No, there's another side. We are instinctively find something wrong with everything that anybody says and does. If they say this is a good car or a good company or a good thing or a good place, when they say this is very beautiful, we think of something wrong with it. We think of just the opposite. The mind is trained like that to find fault where others find things. If somebody says that man is very bad, I think of something good about that person. Giraki. Very interesting point, he says. We mistake the unrealized for the non-existent. That is, what doesn't express today, we say it's impossible. Just because it doesn't exist yet, we say it doesn't, we don't just say it's not that, it'll never be that. It's impossible. That's the 100 crores. When Appa said to MMC, when Appa said that you can build the center here and the JS started the purse and everything, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Somehow on some faith, we do something. But the unrealized became the reality. We're sitting in it. We're living in it. But for mind, for the ignorant mind, what doesn't exist now, not only doesn't exist, it cannot exist. It cannot be realized. We also have the capacity to convert knowledge into ignorance. Even when we know something, we can convert it into its opposite. When Collins, yes, it is. It is creation. It's creation of ignorance. In fact, we do it all the time. If I have a good meditation and all, suddenly I begin to feel self-important. I've converted knowledge into ignorance. It's instantaneous. We do it all the time. If somebody does something out of a great generosity, gives me something, or does something nice to me, the next minute I think, see, I deserved it. Grace comes. Grace comes because of grace, not because of my desert. If it comes as my desert, it's not from grace. The moment I think, grace has come to me, that means I deserved it. I have converted knowledge into ignorance. When I say it's grace, it comes not because I deserve it, but because the divine is so generous and wants to uplift me. The moment I convince myself that there must be something I have done to deserve this, rather I'm important, I have converted knowledge into ignorance. We do it all the time. Every time somebody's generous, I figure out that I deserved it. So instead of appreciating their generosity, I am proud of my own merit. There's every moment we have this opportunity to convert knowledge into ignorance. Janani has been reading, I don't know if she spoke about it, Around the World in 80 Days. Not yet, she'll do it in the future. But some of you know the story, no? You've been discussing the story. This Phileas Fogg is going around the world to show it can be done in 80 days, and incidentally, he's a man where everybody believes it cannot be done because it's never been done. He believes what's never been done can be done. He's a rational man. He's a man who converts ignorance into knowledge. That's what's so beautiful about the story. When everybody says there are so many things you have inadvertently, things you have to account for, you can't tell, there'll be chance here and there, he says there's nothing that's chance. Everything can be accounted for. He's a man who understands and converts ignorance into knowledge. But because at the time of his travel, the Bank of England has been robbed, some people believe he's leaving the country not to go around the world in 80 days, but to run away with all of this money. And this detective Fix, who's a private detective who's been hired by the bank to hunt down, everything that he sees Phileas Fogg do, out of courage and heroism and generosity, he stops to save the Indian princess who's going to be sacrificed to Sati. Saves her life in the process of sacrificing his own journey and everything. Everything he does that's magnificent and heroic, Fix comes to the conclusion he's doing it for an ulterior motive. He converts the good act into a bad act. like the trustee I told you, who, the more the officers do on the right side, the more he accuses them of being on the wrong side. This is a capacity of mind to convert knowledge into ignorance. We also have this strange thing that knowledge and ignorance can coexist in the same person, even at the same time. It's not like now I'm in the knowledge and now I'm in the ignorance. At the same moment that Mr. Bennett is laughing at Collins, he doesn't see that his own behavior is laughable. At the same time that Elizabeth sees Darcy's arrogance and his pride and his offensiveness, she doesn't see her own prejudice. She doesn't see the offensiveness of her own mother and her own family. All our problems come because we're capable of both, even simultaneously. So, I think you get the idea that we have many, many ways. We are very capable of converting knowledge into ignorance in many, many different ways.
Gary, you hear me now?
Yes, clearly. Please, go ahead.
You see, you talk about the power of illusion of people. You gave instances of the illusions that Darcy and Catherine de Bourgh and Lizzie had like that.
Yes.
Now I find devotees having a lot of illusions about the Divine Mother herself. How do we prevent that? The people who read Appa's writing, they come and they get the feeling that the mother is there to give whatever they want, irrespective of whether it is spiritually good for them or not. And when they are told the mother will sanction only those prayers that are spiritually good for them, they look baffled and they just don't understand. They think that she is all compassion, which means they understand compassion to mean that she will give whatever they ask for, and they don't think that she has another aspect of discrimination. One very serious devotee, she came and told me that she is in the habit of visiting other temples. I asked her, what is this? You have been a devotee for 10 years. You say you go and visit other temples. Don't you know? Appa says that those who have come to Mother need not visit other temples. She said, you see, when I go out and go and visit a temple and see the deity there, I imagine that the deity there is Mother herself. I see the deity in the image of the Mother. Therefore, I don't feel I'm doing anything wrong. So people excuse their temple visiting habit, saying that they see the Mother in the image of the deity. Like that, people have so many illusions about Mother. How do we prevent that?
Your statement is very true. Your statement is a specific instance of the general problem. Because all the characteristics, I think I've identified some a dozen characteristics. We could have made it 100 because it's unending, because the ignorance itself is created by the divine and so it has infinite variations. One of the variations is we apply that ignorance even regarding the divinity. And that's how illusionism came. By the same list that I've given here. We just spent 2 months talking about the cosmic illusion, which is the ultimate ignorance. It can't be a greater ignorance than concluding that all of this doesn't exist when it's all divine. So you're giving a dramatic one example, one particular example of the general phenomenon. And I am going to talk about ways in which we can come out of the ignorance just at the end of this talk. But our ignorance is pervasive. Nothing escapes our ignorance. Our views of ourselves, our views of other people, our views of mother, our views of life, our views of everything, family, society, everything. Because, say, if I'm looking through a rose-colored glasses, or I'm looking through a green-colored glass, or whatever it is, everything takes on the tint. If my glasses are magnifying everything or shrink, when I'm looking through a microscope, everything looks bigger when I'm looking, that's the nature of it. The problem with us is the instrument we're using and the way in which we use it. So your example drives home the fact that this applies to everything, even our understanding of what Appa has said or our understanding of what Mother has said, it applies to everything. You know, when we read something, we read for something that we like, and we ignore something that we don't like. Oh, this, then now I can go and tell my husband or tell my wife, you see, Mother says this. In the next sentence or the previous sentence, sometimes in the same sentence, the mother has said something that applies to me. But I'm anxious to tell somebody else what they should believe, meaning that I'm right and they're wrong. This is what we do. So your example is very well taken. Yes, yes, please.
Something in the middle of the
You have given the answer for Ashok's question, and the fundamental answer. What do we do when we live in the ignorance, we're born in the ignorance, we come from the ignorance, and the instrument that we use, the highest instrument we have, is an instrument of the ignorance which creates ignorance. What should we do? This story illustrates that. What should we do? What's the first thing we should do? We should know that we're ignorant. We should accept the fact that we are always ignorant. What do we do now? We say everybody else is ignorant. We spot out the way Mr. Bennett does. We spot out the ignorance in other people. We collect it. We note it down. We speak about it. We should know that we are ignorant. We should know at the best of times, when we are at the most sincere, with the greatest of inspiration. So when Darcy proposes to her, he thinks he's being very sincere. He's, after all, offering her everything he has. At that moment, he's being the most ignorant. Later on, when he looks back on it, he says, I can't believe that I spoke that way. I was so rude and so offensive and everything. Later on, when he proposes the second time, he realizes how ignorant. He quotes what she said at that time to him. And she said, don't speak about those things, let's forget them. No, what you said was correct. The first, why should he write 14 chapters on the ignorance? Because until we realize the nature of our ignorance, nobody's to blame. If I'm made out of flesh, if I happen to be an American or you happen to be Indian, nobody's to blame for that. This is our past. This is, if I speak English as my first language and you speak Tamil as your first language, it's not, but we should know. If I speak English to people who don't speak Tamil or speak Tamil to people who don't speak the language, we should know that we're not communicating. So we must know where we are. These chapters are written not to criticize or abuse, but to make us realize where we are so that we can come out of it and convert from ignorance to knowledge. And that means everything. And Ashok's example only illustrates that applies equally to when we're quoting from Life Divine or quoting Mother's words. Because when we quote Mother's words or we quote an idea, we apply it in a particular context with a particular way, particularly from our point of view or our way of seeing things. We create new ignorances all the time, even when we think we're quoting knowledge. So the first rule, the first fact of our consciousness, which he asks us to accept in this chapter, that's why he's written it, is that we live in the ignorance, and that our mind is not capable of fully coming out of the ignorance and knowing the knowledge. He tells us there is something in our mind that seeks the knowledge. We have to use it. But we should use our capacity to seek the knowledge, not our capacity to convert knowledge into ignorance. And since at every minute, this is what we instinctively do, just like we breathe and the heart is beating, it comes naturally to us. The first thing we should know is not that he's wrong and what she said is wrong and this is wrong and that's not right. The first thing I should know is whatever I believe, whatever I understand, wherever I am, I'm in the ignorance. How do I come out of it? Not how do I correct other people? How do I blame other people? How do I judge other people? At every minute, how do I come out of it? In Mother's Psychic Education, she says the first rule of psychic education is never have faith in the mind's externalized way of seeing things. Meaning, the first thing we need to do is give up the insistence that we're right and recognize that I'm looking through colored glasses, distorting lenses, and at least I shouldn't believe what I see and try to make everybody else believe it. I should try to find a deeper way of knowledge. We're not the only ones who live in the ignorance. He traces in this chapter how the truth that the Vedic rishis saw was converted into the ultimate ignorance by the metaphysical philosophers of Shankara and others, who convinced themselves none of this exists, that all of this is an illusion, because they were using the instrument of mind to know something that can't be known by mind. Because mind knows by contrast, by comparison, by abstraction. So if mind is capable of convincing, Sri Aurobindo says there's been no greater mind on earth than Shankara. But using mind, using the instrument of mind, he's able to come to the conclusion that the world doesn't exist. And he says there's been no greater personality on earth than Buddha. But Buddha came to the conclusion that all life is a wheel of karma and suffering, and the only thing you can do is get out of it, because that's the nature of mind. The problem is not with Shankara or Buddha. The problem is with mind, and that's what we need to come out of. And that's why he says that, not to condemn anybody or find fault with anybody. So we understand the problem is with the instrument we're using. There's some Skype, is that a message? Ashok, a question?
About the power of the supermind.
Yes.
You hear me?
Yes, yes. Please go ahead.
When Sri Aurobindo started writing about the power of supermind, the ashramites all took that to mean that he will remain immortal, and when he passed away in 1950, Appa says that many ashramites felt cheated. What is this? He promised a supermind and he himself has passed away. He has not lived up to his promise. He has cheated us. That is what many ashramites felt. Now, how do you explain for such an illusion with the accusation that he has cheated them?
Nobody felt that they have cheated Sri Aurobindo. That they have come to the ashram saying they were seeking supramental realization, and they have done everything ordinary, worrying about their food and prestige and gossip and everything else, instead of doing what an ashramite should do. Mother says everybody has cheated him. Those who accuse Shurabindo of cheating them are those who are converting, just doing the opposite. It's a good question anybody should ask. Why the supramental didn't, why Shurabindo couldn't stay and complete the work? What did we do wrong? Where did we fail that prevented him from doing the work? That's the right question. Nobody asked that question. Mother answers that question in agenda. She explains it. This is another expression of the human ignorance. We expect the divine to do everything for us, and if everything doesn't happen the way we want it, just because I come and enlist in an ashram, I expect that I'm going to get a boon that even the Vedic rishis didn't get. Is it a privilege? Is it a promise that Mother and Shurabindo owe me this? Or is it an opportunity for me to deserve it and do something to deserve it? If Shurabindo has not done what I thought or wanted him to do, I must ask, what have I done? What's my contribution? How much have I helped him? Mother says everybody was working against it. Mother says everybody was organizing it as a religion. Everybody, she says her body is pricking with pains because people are lying. How can you bring the supramental down by telling lies? So this is a capacity for falsehood and ignorance, which is why the supramental didn't come. The rishis wanted to become temples inside. The temple is not outside. We must become clean inside and a temple for the higher light to come and manifest in ourselves. How can the supramental come or grace come to us when we have falsehood and dirt and ignorance and meanness and all the dark capacities in us? What the rishis did in the Vedic time, the sacrifice was not in the temple. The sacrifice was an inner fire. And on that fire, we are to throw all our impurities. We are to burn and consume all our own impurities so that the higher powers of the gods will descend into us. So, how far have we made our being a temple? Not just our physical, but our vital and our mental consciousness, a temple for the higher powers to come back, to come down. How far was the ashram made itself into a temple? Instead of accusing others, we should look at ourselves. Your example is another example of how we convert. This is a great thing if everybody asks themselves why Shurabindo didn't complete the work. What do I learn from it? What should I do? What should I do so that it can be completed now? If a devotee says, you see, Abba talked about 100 crores, where is the 100 crores? See, it's all talk. Where is the 100 crores? The right thing for him to say is, have I done what I should do to bring the 100 crores? Have I qualified myself? Abba didn't promise that on a certain day the 100 crores is going to come. He has given a detailed method and told us what we should do to deserve it, to bring it. If it's not come, we must ask ourselves, have we done what we're supposed to do? No, he said it would come, it's not come. It's all talk. Who's doing the talk? A good point. So, Shurabindo says, mind not only has a power of ignorance, it also has a power of truth, but a limited power of truth. We cannot know the origin of the ignorance and the nature of the ignorance through our rational mind, because we'll spend the next few thousand years arguing back and forth with the illusionists or the Buddhists or the Vedantists, and we can prove that life's an illusion. We can prove that life is anything we want, because that's the nature of mind. If I have the premise that's an illusion, I can prove, I can give you a rational argument for it. If we really want to know the nature of the ignorance and the relationship between the ignorance and the knowledge, we have to go to a power of knowledge in ourselves that's above the ignorance. And he's going to show us how to do this, tell us how to do this in the subsequent chapters. We have to discover the relationship between the knowledge and the ignorance. In the time of the illusionists, they assume knowledge is one thing, the ignorance is the opposite. They're two different things. And then they created an explanation for how there could be, when Brahman is all, still if there's illusion, where did illusion come from? But in the Vedas, even in the Upanishads, they understood knowledge and ignorance are not opposites. Ignorance is a limitation of knowledge. It's not the opposite of knowledge. There are not two principles. It's like light and darkness, light and shadow. There are not two principles. There's no such thing as darkness as a separate principle. There's light or there's the absence of light. There's light or there's a limitation of light which we call the shadow. There's a shadow. Shadow is not a thing. Light here, shadow there. Shadow is when the light is limited, we see it as a shadow. Ignorance is not the opposite of knowledge. It's not a separate principle. Maya has not created something different than the principle of Brahman, which is all knowledge and all light. When Brahman is concealed, when the spiritual truth is concealed behind the veil, we see it as ignorance. We see it as darkness. We see it as even down to the inconscience. So there is not two principles, there is one. All is from Satchidananda, all is the pure divine consciousness, but the pure divine consciousness can be concealed, can be limited behind. Our ignorance is a limitation of truth, not the opposite of truth. And that's why knowledge can convert itself into ignorance, ignorance can convert itself into knowledge. See, Lizzie says, I hate that man. He's the last man on earth I would ever marry. How does hate become love? If hate is the opposite of love, the truth of the matter is, through the whole story, she's always thinking of Darcy. She's intensely related to Darcy. If you really don't care for a person at all, you'll never think of him. She's always watching. Why is that man staring at me? Why is he doing this? Why is he doing that? The truth of the matter of her relationship with Darcy is, from the moment she first meets him until the final proposal, she's intensely relating to him. Even when the news comes that Lydia has been found and that Wickham will marry her, her first thought is not of Lydia. Her first thought is, why did I tell Darcy about the elopement? She's thinking at the time when her family is saved, the first thought for her is about Darcy. Because all the time, her relationship to Darcy is an intense relationship. When she thought Darcy's condemning her, when she thought Darcy's finding fault with her family, she said, I hate him. When she saw that Darcy's doing so much for her family, that he respects her, that he admires her, that he's even willing to accept her family for her, she says, I love him. From last man, he becomes the first man. So love and hate are not opposites. They're two extreme forms of intense relationship. Knowledge and ignorance are not opposite principles. They're two expressions of the power of consciousness. The power of consciousness to see and be aware of the oneness of everything, or the power of consciousness to see only the divisions and separations between things. But both are powers of consciousness. And the supramental knowledge, the superconscient knowledge that the Vedic rishis were after, was not the knowledge of the one that excludes the many. That's what came later. Later on, we mistook knowledge. Vidya means we must know the one. Knowledge of the world is avidya. Oh, he's a worldly person. He knows all of the worldly things. That's not divine. That's anti-divine. Only the man who knows the one is divine. He may be able to cure and do miracles of health. That's all just avidya. The real knowledge is only the knowledge of the one. That's not what the Vedas or even the Upanishads were saying. In the Upanishads it says, that man is Brahman, that girl is Brahman, that bird is Brahman. Everything is Brahman. The real vidya was not knowledge of the one just by itself. It was knowledge of the one in everything. It was not just knowledge of the one beyond the world. It was knowledge of the one in the world, in everything in the world. And he says in this chapter, if the man who sees only the physical, only the separateness, is in a deep ignorance, equally so, he says, equally so, the person who only thinks the one is real and denies the reality of the many, or denies the divinity of the many, or denies the many are an expression of the one, is equally in an ignorance. The knowledge we want is the knowledge not that wipes out all of this and says it's an illusion or it doesn't exist. The knowledge we want is of the one in the many, of the infinite in the finite, of the timeless there in every moment of time. That is the knowledge. So he says, the mind's tendency is to think of everything in terms of opposites, dualities. So we see love is the opposite of hate. Oh, she would never marry him in a million years. She hates him. It wasn't a million years, it was 1 year. It took only 1 year for hate to become love. For us, pain and pleasure are opposites, as if they're two different things. You can drink pleasure or you can drink pain. There's only one thing, he says. There is ananda. There is the delight of existence. But we can experience the delight of existence as pleasure, or as pain, or as what it really is, pure delight. The pleasure is, I drink something and I like it. Or somebody compliments me and I'm flattered. That's pleasant. The pain is, I do something and it hurts. But the ananda is neither of those. The ananda is there all the time. Regardless of what you tell me, I feel the bliss. Regardless of whether he's drinking poison or he's drinking nectar, he feels the delight. And he can convert the poison into nectar because he knows the ananda in it. Pleasure and pain, he says, are two intensities of the same thing. If somebody gently strokes my arm, I say, that's very nice, feels good. Somebody goes like, ouch. Both are intensities, they're not opposites. Too little, just enough, too much. It depends not on the force. It depends, say, what's a tasty food for you, for many of you anyway, is a burning in my throat and an indigestion in my stomach. I also like a little karma, a little spice. But what's too much for one is not for the other. So our capacity to accept intensity determines whether the intensity for us is pleasant or unpleasant. The children like the loud blasting music. When I was young, I also did. Now it gives me a headache. The music is not different. My capacity for that intensity or attraction to that intensity is different. So pleasure and pain are, we see as dualities, but it's really our capacity for sensation. And the most powerful, intense sensation that exists in the universe is the sensation of ananda. All this idea that I want peace and quiet and calm and nothing, and therefore I want spirit. Spirit is the most intense experience the human being can have. And Sri Aurobindo says it's there in the Vedas. They have the image. If the Vedic, if the Ananda comes down, if the Soma, if the spiritual Ananda comes down into the human body like an unbaked jar, it will break. Because it's not capable of holding it. Sri Aurobindo says when the saint gets the spiritual inspiration, he can't hold it. He can't sit still. He goes and jumps around and dances because it's too much for him. The capacity to receive the Ananda and experience it. That's why Mother says if the divine love came down, the human being would be shattered because we are not capable of receiving it. We're too small. So pleasure and pain are not opposites. Love and hate are not opposites. He says even weakness and strength are not opposites. Each of us has the total power of the divine consciousness behind us at every moment. But whether it how much expresses on the surface, how much is hidden beneath the surface, differs. He says it takes, say, supposing we see the power of the sun. Supposing we have the capacity to stop the sun from shining. Who has the capacity to stop the sun from shining? It takes as much power to stop the sun from shining as the sun has to shine. So what we see as weakness or incapacity is the divine's capacity to hold back what it has. I think we all know it's much more difficult to hold back than to express, no? When we're excited, very difficult to hold back. When I have something to tell another person, very difficult. When I have a secret to share, when they say, I don't know what my problem is, I'm very anxious to tell them what their problem is. No, very difficult not to tell them what I think their problem is. We know how much energy and strength it takes just to be quiet, to be still, to be calm. We can't even stop our own thoughts. The divine, which is infinite power, has the capacity to behave as if it's a stone. It can't move. Unless you move it, it won't move. But that's the divine power. It has the capacity to conceal itself. Weakness is not the opposite of strength. Weakness is a limitation of the expression of strength. Like that, ignorance is only a limitation, a concealing of the knowledge, which means the good news for us is the knowledge is there within us. If we are all this list of ignorances that we have, the knowledge is there within us. Sri Aurobindo says about education, nothing can be taught. Nothing can be taught. True education is to discover the knowledge within. They write about education. Education is to awaken the capacity of the child to discover and learn. That's not exactly what we're doing in the schools now. We are force-feeding it. We're driving it inside. Open your mouth wider now so we can put more inside. That's not knowledge. That's nonsense. So what's the first step for us? If knowledge is inside, if we are an instrument of ignorance and we want to get out of it, we're not going to get it by going to school. We're not going to get it by talking to others. We're going to get it, first of all, by knowing that we're ignorant, by knowing that everything, we need not qualify it, in every way we are ignorant, even in the best of things we're ignorant, by knowing that the mind, by our capacity to divide and particularize, is not going to get us to the knowledge, by withdrawing our faith in the mind and trying to find knowledge deeper inside or higher up than normal. There we can know. We can know. When Darcy heard Lizzie's abuse of him, what did he do? He didn't argue it. He didn't go and quarrel with himself or her and find fault with her or anything. He just quieted his mind. There's truth in what she says. Yes, yes, I never knew myself until now. She says the same thing when she reads his letter. She said, I never knew myself until now. She had the sincerity. They both had the sincerity to want to come out of the ignorance. And that's our human aspiration. We have the capacity to come out of the ignorance. Mind has the capacity not to know the truth, but mind has the capacity to seek the truth. So we can use the mind instead of organizing the ignorance and converting knowledge into ignorance. We can use our mind to tell us, no, 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 not that, not this. Let me not believe this. Let me not judge that. Let me not think that. Let me go inside. Or let me rely not on myself. Let me rely on Mother. Let me consecrate. So how do we turn that power of ignorance into knowledge? And he says in this chapter that because all the knowings seem to be full of ignorance and illusion, in the philosophers came to the conclusion that consciousness itself is a source of illusion. Maya is consciousness. What we want is the pure being. But he said that consciousness is the consciousness of the being. And the only way we can find the being is to find the way to use consciousness to seek the being. We are in consciousness. We are in the consciousness of ignorance. We're in the mental consciousness. But this consciousness is a limited form of the divine consciousness. So he says the supreme discovery. It's a sentence Appa has read 1,000 times and discussed so many times. The supreme discovery for human beings is to know how consciousness in the ignorance can discover, become conscious of the truth, become conscious of the reality. That is our destiny. First, we must know we're in the ignorance. So ignorance can seek to transform itself the way Darcy transformed himself, the way Lizzie became more conscious of herself. How can we overcome the ignorance? Well, he's going to tell us a lot more about it. But I thought we could end, as I gave a list of the ways in which we create the ignorance, we can also have a list. We know many, most of them already. But how can we move in the other direction? We started by saying that consciousness is a power. The first fact of existence is that consciousness is a power. Then let's use that power positively rather than negatively. When Mrs. Bennett aspires for the marriage of her children, she's using the power positively to create opportunity, and it creates maximum opportunity for the family. Then she takes that power and converts it into ignorance by competing with Mrs. Long and Lady Lucas and trying to connive and plan everything for herself. She does the opposite. So our power of aspiration is a positive power of our consciousness. When Phileas Fogg says a man can go around the world in 80 days, the whole world laughs at him and says he's a fool. If he believes the world, he'll never accomplish. Regardless of what the world was, he had faith in the power of knowledge. He had faith in the power of knowledge. Sri Aurobindo and Mother and Appa have given us the knowledge. When Appa says 100 crores, it is the truth. But we must have faith in that truth. Not say, I don't see it, it's not here, I'll see it, I'll believe it when I see it. That's to convert it into ignorance. Then it won't be 80 days or 180 days, it'll be 80 years, and we still won't get around the world because we're waiting for ignorance to come out of itself. We have to come out of the ignorance by stop believing in the ignorance. The Gita has given us a basic method we can become whatever we believe we can become. We must at least believe that. If we don't believe that, we are in the ignorance. If we want to come out of the ignorance, we must know our consciousness is power. Our belief is power. Our faith is power. So if I say I can't do it, it means I don't believe it. I must use belief to create the result, not say I will believe it when I see it. That's one method we can apply. Know that our consciousness is power. The moment you think something negative, you're creating that negativity. The moment you think badly of another person, you're reinforcing and encouraging that negativity to come out of the other person. The moment you think something good won't happen, you are ensuring that it won't happen. So know that every thought of our consciousness has a power to create a result, and use that power in the most positive way we can at every moment. The second is, if we create ignorance by dividing things into opposites, then at each point, whatever I believe, whatever I think is true, know for sure that the opposite is also true. If I think I'm certain about something, I know I'm right. Darcy knows that Wickham's a scoundrel and a liar. He knows that what Wickham is accusing him of is not true. At the same time, he can know there must be a truth in what Wickham is saying, a truth for me, a truth for him. Whatever the most outrageous thing that somebody accuses me of, there must be some truth in it that it comes to me for some reason. I must find that instead of condemning him. And Darcy found out. His arrogance, his sense of superiority was a scandal, was false. And this came to him to help him awaken it. So discover the truth in the opposite point of view. That will make marriage very interesting, no? If all the time we have to discover the truth in our partner's point of view, then of course we'll cleverly say, you see, Gary said, discover the truth in my point of view. That's how we convert knowledge into ignorance, right? The question was, if we discover the truth in others' point of view, will it be useful for us if our point doesn't succeed? Then the question is, what is success? He said, success is to grow from ignorance to knowledge. Success is not to have our point succeed. The success we should want is to go from ignorance to knowledge. That's what's important. In fact, when we go from ignorance to knowledge, all our things will succeed, not because we insist on them, but because we're true. So we must decide, do I want my way? Do I want my preference? Or do I want the truth? If I want the truth, I must know that the opposition that's coming to me has a truth in it. And I should discover the truth in that. Sometimes ignorance is more convenient. To be quoting correctly, ignorance is a greater power than knowledge because it has the capacity to conceal itself. It's knowledge concealed, holding itself back. He didn't say mean that ignorance is better than knowledge. That's our cleverness to convert it from one into the other. Another way we can come out of the ignorance is don't judge anything by its appearances. Isn't that what Darcy did? She's tolerable. Nobody's dancing with her. I'm not here to dance with somebody who's neglected by other men. She judges him. Everybody judges by appearances. We only judge by appearances. seems to be a good person, got a pleasant behavior, comes in a big car, must be rich, has so many things. We only judge. The first rule of psychic education, don't judge anything by its appearances, especially ourselves. Contradictions are compliments. The thing that seems to be the very opposite of what we believe or the opposite of what we want has a truth in it. Try to discover that rather than reject it. No, my way is right, my truth is right, this is right, everybody else is wrong. If my husband doesn't do what I say, he's wrong. Shift from the part to the whole. Even when we know there's a right, a truth, I know something, it's true. Don't insist on the part. Try to look at the whole. Try to look at the whole thing. Look at other points of view. See the big picture, not just the small part. Don't try to justify our own preferences. He wants to go to the marriage. I don't want to go to the marriage. No. Mother Chirapa says don't go to the functions and everything like that. We are brilliant. We are geniuses at justifying our preferences. But when we want something, we won't quote the same. Discover the correspondence between inner and outer. If something is not right outside, instead of saying that's not right and he's not right, why? What is there in me? It helps us move in the right direction. Each of these things, none of these is a guaranteed solution to everything because we are in the ignorance. But each of these is a compass pointing us to the truth. If we follow each of these, we'll know we're going towards the truth rather than going away from the truth further into the ignorance. So each of them can be used. All of them can be used. Don't rely on the physical appearances or physicality. No, I have faith in money. If I had money, I could do it. If my family supports me, I could do it. I could do it, except there's a rule that's in the way. No, my society won't allow this. Society won't support this. In each thing we rely on externally, my organization is like this, my boss is like this, my employees are like this, my spouse is like this, my children are like this, my parents are like this, my in-laws are like this. In each case, shift from the external to faith in Mother, to consecration, not relying on my own effort, as in the Jaya story, relying on Mother. Shifting from my effort, from my knowledge, from my capacity to Mother. So you see, every method that Appa has given us, self-giving, goodwill, every one of these methods is a method that is a compass that says the light is this way, the truth is this way, not that way, not this way, not that way. It's that way. That's what man lacks in the ignorance. We are in darkness. You don't know which way to turn. You don't know which is north and which is south. We can always know which is the true north of truth by applying these principles. Even if we don't know where we're going and we don't know the path, we can know the direction. And when we keep going in the right direction, no matter how much we get turned around and we can point in the right direction, surely we will get there. Surely we will make the progress. Become conscious of other people's existence. That's a very difficult one. It's hard enough I look out for myself. It's hard enough for me to take care of all the things that are in my mind. How to think of other people? How to be thinking about their needs, about what will make them happy, about how to please them. Because we center ourselves in ourself and say, I have to look out for me, and everything I do from my point of view, I'm organizing ignorance because I'm organizing ego. That's the next chapter, the next two chapters. It's going to come to ego, second chapter. It's the heart of our ignorance. So that's why taking the other man's point of view, having goodwill, especially self-giving, is the surest compass to move from ignorance towards the knowledge. Refuse to claim that you know what we don't know. When somebody says, I'm puzzled about this, I don't know why this happened and everything, immediately we're anxious to say, no, this is the reason. Now I know what you know. Refuse to think that we know anything. Even what we're sure we know, begin to question it. Don't try to prove that we know. Try to be aware of what we don't know. Instead of giving answers, raise the questions. Oh, that thing fell. You see, that's why it fell. If it fell here, why didn't that fall instead of this? If it fell at this moment, why didn't it fall at that minute? We give explanations, we're so satisfied with them. But the explanations can raise so many more questions. Refuse to reject as false what's the opposite of what we understand as true. It's very difficult for us. Say, I want the truth. You just tell me, is the answer yes or no? Yes, both. The answer is yes or no. Am I right or he's right? You're both right. You're both wrong. Oh, which is right? Shall I do this or that? Yes, there's a truth in both viewpoints. Now you're driving me mad. When you recognize there's a truth in both viewpoints, you'll find out the answer is not to do this or that. It's to do something else that reconciles them. Refuse to reject as unreal that which is unrealized, that which is not yet realized. How does this all sum up? It sums up as, don't have faith in our capacity to know. Have faith in Mother and shift and rely on her, not on our capacity to know. I think enough for ignorance. Ashok, is that a question? I see your hand up there.
You hear me now?
Yes, yes.
I have a question regarding the illusion of people who believe that they are under Mother's protection simply because they have become devotees. And when something goes wrong with them, they are shell-shocked. How can this happen to me when I am under Mother's protection? It's not clear to me how a person can remain as a devotee and at the same time lose the protection that goes with it. There is some problem of understanding. The person knows he is a devotee and as such he has come under our protection. But some things go wrong with him, like the man falls ill or he loses money or he doesn't succeed in some initiative he takes. And that shows that the alleged protection is not there. And he doesn't understand what he has done wrong to get out of that protection. So the illusion that he is under the Mother's protection gets cancelled. Like yesterday, we got a news that a devotee has suffered an heart attack. And he is in the ICU. His wife is totally baffled. How can this happen to her husband when the man is a devotee? The shock is kind of very powerful. A person can be a devotee but also have a heart attack. This is an impossible situation. Either the person understands that what he has done wrong to get out of the protection, or failing to get the understanding, he must reconcile himself to the fact that you can be a devotee and still not be under the protection in one way or another. The man who had the heart attack is less than 40 years old. This is even more shocking.
This is the fundamental. Your question comes. He constantly talks in this chapter about the ignorance created by the dialectical intellect. The dialectical intellect tries to know by dividing things into opposites. Your question is an expression of that. You have divided the world into devotees and non-devotees. You have taken the word devotee to be one reality, non-devotee to be another reality, and things exist in one state or another state. This is what the illusionist did between knowledge and ignorance. That is, knowing the one is knowledge, anything else is ignorance. So I have to turn around, first of all, and ask you, what does it mean to be a devotee? Is to be a devotee a place or a status? Say, if I have enlisted in the university and then I don't get a job, I don't get past grades, I don't get a diploma. I said, I don't understand. I enrolled in the university and I've not gotten pass marks and I've not gotten diploma and I'm not getting an employment like everybody else. What did you do? I enlisted. I enrolled. Did you go to class? Did you study? Did you take the exams? Did you qualify yourself? I went to university. You said if I go to university, I become a success. Going to university means the enrollment is only the first step. That gives you the privilege of learning. I came to mother, and you say things are not going everything perfectly the way I did. Coming to mother is like enrolling in the university. It's the first step. There's so many steps. We take it in a dialect.
People can't be so stupid as you assume.
If people assume that because they've enrolled the child in a course, that the ultimate result must come, that the other people who enrolled in the course have got jobs in America and are earning $100,000 a year, why it hasn't happened to my child who never went to class. If you say that they're not capable of that distinction, I'd say that we are deeply in the ignorance and there's no hope of answering this question. The first thing we have to understand is, what does it mean to be a devotee? It's a wonderful question. I wish you write a speech on it and deliver it. And everybody answer it, and we all ask ourselves, to what extent am I a devotee? What does it mean? Devotee is not a black or white. Devotee is not something that comes because of I went to the center once or I keep a photo of mother in my room. What does it mean? Appa's writing about what it means to be a devotee. How far do we qualify ourselves? You talk about it, how could a heart attack come to the person, but this is a person who within a few hours, the doctor said he's all right and his blood pressure is normal. Then you must look at it the other way. You must look at it how the grace came. There are so many people who have heart attacks and it's over. And within 2 hours that the patient is talking and that there was he could get to a doctor and he could get treatment and he could return to a place where he can talk. And you're looking at it from one side. You're not looking at it from the other side. Mind, when it divides reality this way and, oh no, this is all bad or this is all good or this is all right or that's all wrong, we'll never get to the answer. Knowledge is more complex. So I think the right starting point, you raised the most wonderful question. especially for you, because you constantly ask this, and Appa has answered you many, many times in my presence. What does it mean to be a devotee? Let's ask that question. What does it mean? How do we receive Mother's grace? How do we receive her protection? What is the process? What do we do for that? How do we move closer to Mother? How do we move away from Mother? If we all devotees have seen that in some area of their life has flowered because of their relation to Mother, and there'll be other areas of their life which haven't flowered, then we must ask how Mother has not given me in all areas. We must ask, how did it come in one area and not in another? We need a knowledge that we don't have now. In other words, even when we become devotees, we're still devotees in the ignorance. We don't know what it means to be a devotee. We have several ideas and understandings and attitudes that are completely opposite to that of being a devotee. We have the ignorance of thinking, because I have been to the center and I call myself a devotee and I put Mother's photo, that all the benefits of being a devotee that Appa ever wrote about should come to me, which is exactly like, how come I haven't gotten my job offer in the States? I don't have a home in the States. I enrolled in the universities 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I still haven't been there. I still don't go to class, but I'm waiting for the results. So you've asked a very right question. And if my presentation today leads all of us to reflect on the answer to this, your question, and we gain some light, some knowledge about what it means to be a devotee, then this would have really served the purpose today.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you. You've made the best, most important contribution to today's talk. Great. Anything else? Okay.
Gary sir's speech, Sandy. Knowledge and ignorance, namba nareya kekra vaarthai aanalum adu oru pudhiya dimension la iniki vera level la oru opening kuduthirukku. இப்போ லாஸ்ட்ல அசோகன் சார் கேட்ட கேள்வி, அவர் என்ன சொல்லியிருக்காருன்னா, ஹூ இஸ் தி டிவோட்டி? டிவோட்டினா எப்படி புரிஞ்சுக்கிறது, எப்படி யார் டிவோட்டி? அத அப்ப நம்மளுக்கு நிறைய ஒரு க்வெஸ்டின்ஸ் நிறைய இருக்குங்கிறதுல நம்மளுக்கு ஒரு எக்ஸசைஸ் இருக்காங்க. அந்த எக்ஸசைஸ நம்ம பண்ணினா இந்த நாலேஜ் அண்ட் இக்னரன்ஸ் இந்த சாப்டர்ல நாம என்ன புரிஞ்சுட்டோம்ங்கிறத நாம எக்ஸ்பிளைன் பண்ண முடியும். பட் இது வந்து ஒரு என்ஜாயபிள் செஷனா இருந்ததுங்கிறதுக்கு மேல, நம்ம வந்து நாலேஜ்ன்னு நினைச்சுக்கிறது தான் இக்னரன்ஸ்ங்கிறது அவர் கிளியரா சொன்னார். நம்ம எல்லாம் நாலேஜ்ன்னு நினைச்சுட்டு இருக்கிறது தான் இக்னரன்ஸ். நமக்கு நாலேஜ்னா என்னன்னு தெரியாம இடத்துல நம்ம இருக்கோம். அப்ப அந்த இடத்த தான் நம்ம, அதாவது எந்த இடத்துல அந்த நமக்கு தெரியாம இருக்கோ அதுதான் அந்த சென்சிட்டிவ் பாயிண்டா இருக்கும். அதை நம்ம ஏத்துக்கணும் எடுத்துக்கணும்ங்கிறத இந்த சாப்டர் வழி அவர் கன்க்ளூட் பண்ணியிருக்காரு. ரொம்ப நல்ல சந்தோஷமான செஷன். நல்ல நிறைய க்வெஸ்சன்ஸ் ரைஸ் ஆயிட்டிருக்கு. இனிமே வர வர செஷன்ஸ்ல நிறைய க்வெஸ்சன்ஸ் வந்துட்டே இருக்கும். அஸ்வன் சாருக்கு ரொம்ப தேங்க்ஸ். இந்த மாதிரி இப்ப இந்த க்வெஸ்சனை இங்கே சென்டர்ஸ்ல நாங்க ரைஸ் பண்றோம். டிவோட்டினா யாருங்கிறது இப்ப எல்லாருக்கும் ஒரு பயமே வந்துருக்கும். ஏன்னா நாங்கெல்லாம் என்ன நினைச்சுட்டு இருக்கோம், இல்ல எல்லாரும் டிவோட்டி மதர் எங்களுக்கு தர்ம் பண்ணணும்னு நினைச்சுட்டு இருக்கோம். அப்ப டிவோட்டிங்கிற கேள்வியை நீங்க எழுப்பிட்டீங்க. ரொம்ப தேங்க்ஸ் அசோகன் சார். அண்ட் நான் நான் வந்து இப்போ ஐ எம் தேங்கிங் சார் கேரி ஸ்பெஷலி டெலிவரிங் தி ஸ்பீச் வெரி பிளசன்ட்லி. அன்னை அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் நன்றி, வணக்கம் கூறி விடைபெறுகிறோம்.